For those of you who don't know me, my name is Reverend Hario, and I am one of Ramesher Jiyu's disciples. I turned up here in 1972, which is mind-boggling when I think about it. But it's amazing what happens if you just take it one day at a time. I'd like to read you, to start off with, a short piece from a book entitled Martin Bain on Turning the Stream of Compassion Within. Martin is a friend of mine, and he was a monk side by side with me in the early 70s. And his life took many twists and turns, and as I understand it, as the result of a car accident, he was diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's at an early age and ended up at the age of 53 living in an assisted facility, being 30 or 40 years younger than everyone around him. And he was recently interviewed in the National Public Radio Fresh Air program by Terry Gross. And what he saw happening around him to the elderly got his attention. And he calls himself an observer advocate and writes about long-term care reform for the elderly. He writes other things too. He's a great writer, period. And I had the good fortune to connect with Martin after many years when he got in touch to check the accuracy of a story he was thinking about writing that had to do with a trip he and I took as young monks back east. That's a whole nother story. But we got this there's things called drive-away cars, where if someone moves from one part of the country to another, companies hire another person to drive their car from point A to point B, and he and I did that from San Francisco to New York, and we had a 57 Chevy going that way because it was a classic car, and they don't use salt on the road, so, you know, California cars, the undercarriage isn't damaged by the salt. So anyway, we had a 57 Chevy going that way and a brand new front wheel drive Toronado going this way, which that was quite a car in its time, but it was like a spaceship compared to the Chevy, although the Chevy had a certain panache of its own. But anyway, he wanted to check the details of our trip, and we reconnected, and since then, you know, we've kept in touch. And this book, which is a small book, and can be found as a Kindle download and the like on Amazon, is essentially autobiographical, and the chapters are short, and each vignette is about something that has happened in his life, but the way he presents it, it's about a lot more than his life. It's about our lives and lives in general. And they're just very short and powerful, the kind of thing that if you get into bed and read one and turn out the light, you just end up looking at the ceiling for a while and just trying to absorb, you know, what you just read. And a significant part of his book and what the book leads to has to do with his advocating for elder care and trying to help people understand how it is and where there needs to be improvement. And so if for that reason alone, if you're a person who hasn't yet figured out how to keep from getting old, there's something in this book for you. So So anyway, I'll read his story. It's called Lessons from the Woodpile. And this chapter's, you know, the book is about his life in general, but this particular short chapter has to do with it. His first coming here for a retreat. Tucked away in the Siskiyou Mountains of Northern California, surrounded by dense forests of conifers and manzanitas, is Shasta Abbey, a Soto Zen Buddhist monastery. In 1972, after completing a year-long retreat at a Catholic Benedictine monastery, I decided to continue my spiritual journey. I applied to Shasta Abbey for a 3-week training session. Little did I know the training session would become a 4-year monastic sojourn. Zen emphasizes the attainment of enlightenment, seeing one's face before they were born, through the practice of meditation, de-emphasizing dogma, faith, and the need for a deity. The meditation called Zazen literally means to sit quietly. Raised as a Roman Catholic, a religion steeped in tradition, faith, dogma, and belief in the physical manifestation of God's Son as Jesus Christ, I was prepared for a substantial construct shift. Yet during a 3-week training session, I can assure you the greatest challenge I faced was neither existential or spiritual. It was a pile of wood. And then he lists the schedule, 5:30 meditation, 6:20 morning service, etc. You can imagine it's very, very much like we have today, 8:30 evening office, 9:00 lights out. As you can see from the schedule, there was a 9:15 a.m. community working period session every morning. On the first day of my training retreat, I drew the woodpile as my work assignment. The monks had recently asked for and received permission from a neighbor to tear down an old barn on the neighbor's property. It saved the owner the expense of having it done professionally and provided the monks with a supply of lumber for construction projects. River Master Jiyu Kenet Roshi, the monastery's abbess and spiritual director, had instructed the monks to stack all the lumber from the barn into 3 piles. At the center of the compound, each pile was approximately 10 feet tall. Because the lumber still contained nails, each board had to be inspected for nails. The nails were then removed, straightened, and sorted by size into coffee cans. Keeping in the spirit of Zen, a good second-hand nail is every bit as useful as a new one. I thought to myself, sounds simple enough. But I was very wrong, and in a matter of minutes, the woodpile would become my nemesis. More than happy to point out my undisciplined, lazy, impatient nature. Pick up a board, pull out the nail, straighten the nails, sort by size, place in coffee can. Pick up a board, pull out the nails, straighten the nails, sort by size, place in coffee can. Pick up a board, pull out the nails, straighten the nails, sort by size, place in coffee can. Everything inside me rebelled. My only satisfaction were those brief moments I fantasized about pouring gasoline over the pile, lighting a match, seeing the match in slow motion tumble end over end before turning the boards into an inferno. Worse, I worked on the woodpile alone. For me, the equivalent of banishment on an isolated archipelago. No one to talk to and nothing to distract me. Just me and the boards. On my first day of work on the woodpile, I was irritable and depressed. My only hope was that the monks shifted work assignments on a daily basis. No such luck. By the end of the second day on the pile, I was an emotional wreck. On the third day, when they announced the work assignments after breakfast, I was again banished to the woodpile. My frustration turned to anger. I came here to be enlightened, not pull nails out of boards, became my mantra, and I spent most of the work period throwing my carpenter's hammer against trees, pacing back and forth, and convincing myself that I would take the next plane back to New York. On the fourth day, I finally became unglued. When they announced that I would be at the woodpile for yet another day, I stood up and stomped out of the room, swearing under my breath. And the time it took to reach the woodpile, I had resolved to call the airlines and return home. Once I'd made the decision to leave, the pressure was off, and I hid among the boards and took a nap. When I woke, I checked my watch and realized I'd overslept, missed lunch. Under normal circumstances, I would have been concerned, but because I had already made the decision to leave the next morning, I decided to hang out at the woodpile and collect my thoughts before going back to my cottage to pack. I was relaxed now. The anger and depression had lifted, and I was looking forward to the trip home. With time on my hands, I decided to pull a few nails for old time's sake. I lifted the first board, removed and straightened the nails, and placed them in their appropriate coffee cans. I did it again and again until it became a fluid exercise, a dance. That's when I realized something remarkable was happening. The ubiquitous background chatter in my mind was gone, and in its place, a peace I had never known. No internal debates, scolding myself, or dreaming about the past or future. There was only the sound of hammer against nail, nothing else. For the next 4 hours, I'd lost complete track of time, I pulled and straightened nails, joyously, mindfully, completely at peace with myself. Then, as the light began to fade, I noticed a heavy-set woman walking towards me. "Will you be leaving us?" she asked me. "If it's okay with you," I said, with tears streaming down my face, "I'd like to stay to finish the rest of the retreat." "Well then, lad," she said, "you'd better grab some grub. You must be starving." I wiped the tears from my eyes and looked up, but Roshi had already begun walking towards her house. So this says a lot to me. "Well then, lad, you better grab some grub. You must be starving." It brings back a lot of memories for those of us who were there then, which I wish I could share them with you. But it says something about her, and just makes me want to say I'm glad she was my teacher, and I'm grateful for the opportunity she gave me, the place where I could come to and do my own inner practice and looking within whilst she did hers. And I'm grateful I stuck with it. Some of the things that this article says to me have to do with expectations, the role of a teacher, and perhaps most significantly, how the world we see around us is very often created or conditioned by what's going on inside of us. In Martin's case, things were unfair and became untenable, however you might describe it, and he said, "I'm out of here." He gave himself that out, which took the pressure off. No reason to fight. The fight was over. He'd won. All that remained was for him to leave. So, with no fight, no pressure, no need to engage with his judgments, he said, "Heck, I'll just pull some nails. You know, why not?" And so that's what he did. He just pulled nails. However, he did so with more of a mind of meditation than before, either by accident or because presumably he'd be given meditation instruction as part of the retreat, and he remembered that and thought, "Oh, that's kind of what we're supposed to be doing, isn't it? So, but in any case, he just pulled nails, and as a result, the clouds lifted on their own. And he knew something of the bright nature of his mind, which is the same as the mind of the Buddha, and the same as your mind and my mind as well, and which is our birthright to know, and which we receive as if a gift, although we have it already, when we choose to stop making the clouds. However, to stop making the clouds does not mean that you look for the bright nature of the mind. It means you let go of this and that, and you let go of letting go. And when seeing through new eyes, to the extent that you are able, you have more of an understanding of what clouds are, what is meant by clouds. And you have more of an understanding of how they color your view and how subtle they can be. And even though subtle, how profoundly they can influence how you see the world. This doing of meditation is actually a deep act of faith, because it includes not seeking to understand anything. But understanding is where it's at, isn't it? We are understanding beings, and that's our way in. But you have to let go of that and have faith in what might be called our fundamental enlightened nature, all sorts of words for it. And that faith is a basic tenet of Soto Zen. Soto Zen in its widest sense being the tradition we derive our practice from, although we tend to refer to ourselves as within the serene reflection tradition, because Soto Zen is commonly associated with the Soto Zen Church of Japan, and we are not members of the Soto Zen Church of Japan. And this practice can be utterly joyful if we accept its simplicity. It's not uncommon for it to take decades to actually believe that meditation is as simple as it is. It can be utterly joyful if we accept its simplicity and just let the meditation do its interior work and not worry about it. Just carry on with normal daily life. In this way, our practice is the comfortable way, as some people have described it. No great efforts required. Just, it's like driving the speed limit. It's as easy as driving the speed limit. However, the idea of the comfortable way is not one easy to maintain. And it's not uncommon for the circumstances of our practice to become difficult, if not exceedingly so. Does this have to be the case? No. Is it a requirement? I certainly hope not, but it just seems to be what some of us do to ourselves at times. We end up going a way that is not so comfortable. However, this has a positive side to it. The nature of which I don't completely understand, and Martin's story is an example of what I'm talking about here, as is the life of the Buddha, in that as the legend goes, and you can look at the legend in all sorts of ways, I tend to look at it as the meaning within the story and not worry about whether the story is true or not. But as the legend goes, he got so desperate in the end that he sat himself down with the intention of not to rise before he had found enlightenment. There was a man in extremity. Pushed to the limits, no way out that he could see except just sit there. And there is something about these states of extremity that seems to potentiate a certain movement within us. that if through whatever means we can muster, we get ourselves out of the way, and that movement is allowed to happen, we can see life as if with new eyes. I'm reminded of a story we probably all have heard about Reverend Master Jiu getting so fed up in Sojiji that she walked out, but at the last minute decided I could be wrong and turned around and enabled that energy. Got herself out of the way, wound herself up, got herself out of the way, and then sprawling. And those who know, you know, usually through their own experience about this aspect, can be that sometimes comes up in training, know that when they see another in a certain type of extremity, how important a time is at hand for them. But they and our fates are in our own hands, and I wouldn't pretend to know what the answer is for another who is in such a place. But if that place is one of these places of great potential and opportunity, that opportunity can be lost if the person distracts themselves away from facing what's gotten hold of them. Which is why sometimes you just have to let somebody be. And to do otherwise is harmful to them. Although that harm may never be appreciated. But for some, their answer is to choose to go on and choose not to look down, but at least try to look ahead. Sometimes looking up is just too much to ask, but if you just can at least look ahead, that can be enough. It can keep you going. And if you do, you can come out the other side of these times transformed. Transformed as one who has had everything taken away, but then empty-handed, sees in those empty hands a sufficiency that is beyond all measure, which no one gave to them and no one can take away. A man stands in his own shadow, but only he can turn around, as this phrase goes. A woman stands in her own shadow, and only she can turn around as well. So I've used the phrase letting go a couple times, and it's one of our, you know, you hear it a lot around here. And I'd like to say something about it because it tends to be something that people misunderstand, at least as far as, you know, my use of it. Letting go is not pushing away anything. It's not rejecting, or it's not trying to deny or get rid of anything. If you're grasping tight on something, and you let go of it, you simply stop the grasping. The thing doesn't vanish. You're just no longer stuck to it, bound to it. You achieve a new relationship with it that is freer than the one you had when you were stuck and bound to it. And you can pick the thing up as you need it and put it down when you don't. So in meditation, we don't push away, suppress or deny anything. We just notice what's there, and in what becomes more of a reflex action rather than a conscious effort, we don't grasp after it or chase it or push it away. We just let it go its own way. It may come back. That's okay. Then you just let it go again. It may come back. That's okay. Just let it go again. It doesn't matter what it's doing. What matters is what you do, your choice to, okay, I see that, I'm just going to let it go without judgment. And when we let it go, where we go when that happens can only be described with words that are puzzling to someone whoever hasn't done the practice. But to those who have and have known some degree of what I can only describe as consummation within that place, they know that it is enough. It is enough. And it is nothing. Although I really want to say it's not even that. However, whereas in formal meditation we have the luxury of being able to let go completely, daily life requires that we engage with it. And that involves bringing our intellect, our intuition, all aspects of our being and our views and thoughts and opinions, and bring that into daily life and to act upon them. And that's active meditation. And if we've developed a relationship with our views of the sort I've talked about, then there needn't be a problem. And to think that to have views and to act based on views, to think that that's not consistent with the mind of active meditation, is to not have a mature understanding of how meditation works and where it must take you. The key is how we hold things, how we hold our views and opinions and judgments. We've all got them. The key is how we hold on to them. If we hold on to them lightly, let me put it this way, it's very hard to bash somebody over the head with something you're holding very gently and lightly. Another thing that the story brings to mind is expectations, which again, we're human, we've all got them. And in Martin's case, he didn't put them down, but he carried them with him. When we expect something in particular, we may miss something that's much better, although different than what we may have imagined. Expectation can create barriers where no barriers exist, or orient us, or orientate us, you know, for the British, in ways that are fundamentally unhelpful to practice. Recently I was asked, what helps to keep a meditation group together? And one thing I mentioned is the importance of kind of our mindset or our approach that we come to practice, to a meditation group, to a temple. If we go and then come back and say, okay, what am I getting out of this? Is it meeting my expectations? You know, we go and we come back and we look at our wheelbarrow and say, what have I got in my wheelbarrow that, you know, that I got from this? Is it worth the effort? Well, that's one way to do it, but I suggest turning things around. Don't look at going to the temple or the meditation group or your practice or your cushion as something that you want to come away with more in your wheelbarrow. Look at it as an effort where you come away from having given something of yourself, having lightened your load. Have a little less in this wheelbarrow. Come to give, you know, come to give, not to take, and then see whether it's worth it. You know, that'll be much more worth it in terms of what's important if you have, if you see it as leaving, lightening your load, thinning the self, giving of yourself rather than taking. That's really what this is all about. We're not about building ourselves up, building up understanding, building up rank, title, position. We don't need to become more than what we are fundamentally already. You are the crown of creation, to quote the song. You don't need anything more than what you've already got. And letting go of what you think you are enables you to see what you really are in a much deeper sense. I also said to the person who asked what helps a meditation group continue, and I said, appreciate those around you. It's a bit unusual to be called to do this strange practice of all gazing. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And appreciate the fact that the person sitting next to you has demonstrated a willingness to sit down on a cushion and enter a relationship of really profound humility with everything by letting go of who they think they are, what they think they are. It's just not common. And how we are called to do this, I don't know. The call is just so quiet and gentle and so easy to be drowned out. It's like a melody heard in the womb, long time forgotten. Then in life, you hear it and something is stirred and you turn towards it. I don't understand it. And at the same time, I don't think it's unique to us. I don't assume that other people aren't doing it in life. We're not special beings. But there is something about seeing someone as yourself, seeing someone make an effort to turn towards that and to do the kind of work on themselves that is associated with turning towards that. So appreciate one another. Don't take each other for granted. See the merits, you know, of their efforts. And see them as a vessel of truth. Not truth in the sense of holding right or wrong views, but of a living truth that they embody by virtue of simply being a human being. Speak kindly to one another. We talk about compassion, acceptance, tolerance towards all beings. But often in our loftiness with this, we forget to practice it with one another. And do not be proud of yourself, or devalue others, is the precept. If you find yourself devaluing others, look within quickly. If you do it wrongfully, spitefully, hatefully, belittling another, you harm yourself far more than anyone else could harm you. If you attempt to say, look at them, you separate yourself from them, and you separate yourself from everything on the spiritual level. And it's as backwards as, and not unlike drinking poison, thinking it will affect another. And there may be times when we do have to point out someone's mistakes, especially if you have that responsibility. But pay attention to how you're doing it. Most of us probably have some roles in which we have a relationship with children or coworkers where we have some responsibility and just can't let things freewheel in all directions. You know, there's that aspect in my role. And I'm human. I can get wound up and I can express something in a way that I regret. What I said might still be true, but the package that it's delivered in kind of distracts from the message, and I regret that. And I myself have to look at what I've done and reel myself back in and try to do better next time. So, again, I'm still on the what keeps a group together, and I guess I'm talking about us too as a group. Just value one another, even if they drive you crazy. You're probably driving somebody crazy. And care about them. Care about them more than you care about your ideas. Caring about them is an expression of caring about the truth. And for those in particular with a group or a small group, make the Sangha appear. Don't just stand back and wait for the Sangha appear that you can then join. The Sangha is you. The Sangha is you. And your turning up makes the Sangha appear. The last aspect of Martin's article that I want to mention is the role of the teacher. One aspect of which is the teacher's offering of encouragement and guidance at critical times. The story Marty conveyed reminded me of the early days when the community was smaller, life out of necessity was a little simpler. We didn't have the buildings to do ceremonies in, so it was working meditation. It was the way of works was in the ascendancy at that period of time. And Verve Master G was much more mobile, much more around, and she had more strength and was much more able to just give those little signs of encouragement at the right moment. I think she regretted to some extent when the community became larger and she was just one person. She couldn't have the sorts of relationships that she would have liked to have with everyone. And there was much more relied on, well, these folks are serious, so I'm just going to have to rely on them doing their own practice and I can do the best I can to help them. A teacher doesn't bestow understanding on anyone. Teacher gives you a wall to look at and tries to keep out of the way to doing their own training as best they can. It's up to us. It's up to us as to what we do, with the wall we're given. And if we think we're not getting enough out of it, there's probably something we can do to get more out of it. We make the practice what it is, and that applies to monk, lay person. Doesn't matter. Practice is practice. It's up to each of one of us to plant the seed, or more correctly, see the seed that's been planted there already. Care for it, water it day by day with simple practice, and it will flower over time. This flowering is everyone's potential. Monks aren't first in line in this regard. We each have our own door to heaven right directly in front of us, the knobs right there. And there are no rules as far as this is concerned. There's no reason why anyone, a brand new layperson off the street, who's just new to the practice, who sits down, there's no reason why, there's no rule that say they can't just zoom past everybody in terms of, coming to understand some very important things about themselves. And I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen where someone who we'd never seen before sits down and, whoa, very obvious. So they've sort of plumbed some depths there. And I've seen a ripple go through the monastic community, and it's like, well, this is supposed to happen to us. What's going on here? And they scramble to kind of get their act together, and a little more monks are showing up to the meditation hall than before, and that sort of thing. So there's only one Eightfold Path, and it's open to everyone. Monks might have a certain advantage in that their life is arranged to foster a certain concentrated study and effort, but it's not the life, it's not the externals, it's the concentrated effort. It's the effort that's important, and not the externals. It's the effort that gives one the advantage. We live in the world of appearances, of the opposites. one thing is not another. One thing cannot be another. It doesn't look like another. So we have that which appears as a monk. We have that which appears as a lay person. We have lay people that do this. We have lay people that do that. We have monks who do this. We have monks who do that. We have monks who we call this. We have monks who we call that. We have monks who wear this. We have monks who wear that. Everything cannot be everything else. And do not let the distinctions that are part of life as it is become a red herring that you chase and distract you from doing your own inner work. I'm not sure you'd want to catch a red herring. These distinctions are just part of the dream. They're just part of the dream. The gateway to enlightenment and to awakening stands open wide. It's as wide as the ocean. It's as wide for you as it is for me. And time flies as an arrow flies from a bow. So, thank you very much for coming.